Professor Davis, Mr. Eisenberg, Mr. Lee, and Mr. Quinn. Ladies and gentlemen, guten Tag, and a very good evening to all of you. Welcome to Singapore Management University to this evening's Shaw Foundation Distinguished Faculty Lecture Series. I'm Chesson, a second-year student at SMU School of Law. Our speaker this evening is Dr. Andreas Wegen, independent consultant and former chief scientist of Amazon.com. Dr. Wegen will be speaking on the topic, the new business model, mean business. I would also like to acknowledge our panelists for today, Mr. Michael Eisenberg, chairman and COO of Acor Asia Pacific, Mr. Andrew Lee, senior executive vice president and head of global consumer financial services, OCBC, and Mr. Quek Pek Ling, executive vice president of the consumer group and chief executive officer, Singtel Mobile, Singapore Telecommunication Limited. Our chairperson for this evening is Practice Associate Professor John Davis, Director of Center for Marketing Excellence at Singapore Management University. May I now invite Professor Davis to give a more detailed introduction of our speaker today. Professor Davis, please.
Well, good afternoon. Look at all of you. This is great. What a turnout. You're in for a very, very special treat today. This is an unusual set of conditions we're in, as we know, economically. And it's critical for our businesses to have a more customer-centric point of view. We know that, but how do you use the data, for example, to really create new growth pathways? That's what's going to be interesting today. As you'll see momentarily, Dr. Andreas Wegen is an intensely passionate person about people and data, and in fact, the data they produce. He's not just passionate, he's energetic. As you'll see when he gets up here on stage, I had a chance to see him this morning in another session, and it is amazing. You really enjoy what you're gonna hear. And it's that passion that'll come through in convincing you about the new ways of looking at the consumer data revolution. Dr. Wegen now works as an independent consultant with renowned firms around the world, including Alibaba, Lufthansa, MySpace, and Nokia, and others. He helps us leverage the principles of the consumer data revolution for innovating products and business models, as well as identifying emerging trends in social media and data strategy for practical uses. Dr. Wegen has published over 100 scientific articles and co-authored 6 books. He teaches the graduate course in data mining and electronic commerce at Stanford University and marketing and Web 2.0 at UC Berkeley. He has also taught at the New York University Stern School of Business and University of Colorado at Boulder. He received his PhD in physics from Stanford University. He was also a researcher at Xerox PARC, which is the Palo Alto Research Center, as well as the Santa Fe Institute. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming and giving a kind Singapore welcome to Dr. Andreas Wegen.
Okay, thank you so much. All right, what are we going to do in the next 45 minutes together? I'll first talk to you about what Web 1.0, Web 2.0, and even Web 3.0 is about. Then we'll talk about the revolution which is happening right now, which is the consumer data revolution. I'm taking the perspective of economics to this, where I'm going to discuss costs and benefits, both as central moments and as extreme values. We're going to talk about decision-making and how the attitudes of users have been changing, because ultimately this is actually a people revolution, not a technology revolution. Then I turn the question, what does this mean to data? And also, what does it mean to individuals? What are the strategic implications, specifically, what data strategies do individuals as well as companies need to come up with? I'm going to talk about which companies I think will make money, namely those that actually reduce information asymmetry. No longer that one-sided mirror you can look through but not look out. And I think those companies that really emphasize genuine relationship economics as opposed to transaction economics, not those carriers who say, if you get this phone for 24 months, you are paying me every month. That's being held hostage. That's not a relationship. I'll give you lots of examples and try to crystallize out some of these trends, and then I'm greatly looking forward to actually hearing a discussion, having a genuine dialogue with my three friends who we have spent hours with in the last 2 days already arguing. So you'll see that's the highlights of that. Web 1.0, ladies and gentlemen, is e-business. The company is in the center. Web 2.0 is me business. The individual is in the center. And Web 3.0, any idea? Well, I know it's not grammatically entirely correct, but let's call it we business, which actually is where the community is in the center. So I'm focusing this talk today about Web 2.0, about me business, but then gently we'll move from just attributes about the user to attributes between users, to relationships between people, to we business. Web 2.0 is actually people 2.0. Web 1.0 focused on pages. Web 2.0 focused on people. Web 1.0 focused on gathering data, whatever you can get, whether people know it or not, and it focused on experimentation. I ran hundreds of experiments at Amazon.com where I tried this and that and the other, and that actually is one of the secrets of Amazon, that there's just constant experimentation and a Darwinian evolution, which is happening at very fast speed. So when you talk about things happening in internet time, what we mean is really that the cycle is no longer months, but the cycle becomes minutes. In contrast to that, Web 2.0 is not about technology. Web 2.0 is about what people do. It's about participation, about individuals in their individuality. So in some way, we can be cute and say Web 1.0 is about impressions. Web 2.0 is about the impressed. What are some business implications of me business? First of all, there's a true focus on the customer, on the individual. When I work with companies, that's always the really interesting thing to see that they say, of course, the customer is king, but then slowly they're realizing actually that what they thought was customer-centric can be pushed much further than they ever thought. For instance, when companies talk about CRM, customer relationship management, they typically mean, you know, how can I get that flypaper up? So if the customer gives me his little food, he will stay there forever and potentially die. Instead, let's do VRM, vendor relationship manager, me as an individual in the center say, hey, dear carriers, what do you have to offer to me? Or, hey, dear airlines, I need to go to San Francisco. Come up, make me a good offer. And I'm willing to be flexible. So the transaction types will be much more flexible than just buying a stupid ticket. Hey, I don't care whether I'm flying tomorrow, or the day after tomorrow, versus I need to be on that flight. Otherwise, I'll actually miss my class on Monday at Berkeley. Three further implications. One, the systems are engineered for feedback. I sometimes say we want to instrument the world. Instrumenting the world means we want to put probes up everywhere and measure what's happening. And I'll give you a number of good examples of what it really means to invent the world. Interesting enough, my PC, the more I use it, the slower it gets, the worse it gets. Whereas Google, Amazon, the more people they use, the better it gets. That's interesting. The more data they have, the faster they get, the better preferences they can get. Interesting difference. Second of three is network effects, so network externalities, if you want to be an economist, which sometimes is called viral marketing. So you all know from manufacturing that if you make one shirt, it's more expensive per shirt than if you make 1,000 shirts. That's economies of scale of production. It's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about economies of scale of demand. And that means if somebody already is on a social network, by you going to the same social network, you add value potentially to all the people in that social network. A standard example, of course, in school is that of the fax machine. How much would you pay for the first fax machine? Actually, does anybody remember fax machines? Those things, big boxes, paper inside, stupid devices. You shouldn't pay anything because you can't best, you know, you can fax yourself, I guess. But if the more fax machines there were 20 years ago, the more useful it became. The third point between, besides engineering systems for feedback and leveraging network effects is to come up with a data strategy. And data strategy means to have a platform so users can generate value. Generate value for themselves as well as value for others. As well as value, most importantly, if you're a business person, for the company. Example, Google Maps, which you probably most of you know, allows you to generate value by adding little tags there. For instance, a phone company in the United States said, we could have those cars continuing driving around, and with this gas price, it's getting importantly expensive. So why don't we instead put up Google Maps and allow our dear customers to simply put little push pins where the service is bad? And then, week after week, we put a new shelter up there and say, hey, we are listening to our customers. Those who had their push pins there, for instance, 280 and Sand Hill Road in California, now you don't have to worry about dropping your calls anymore. We will listen to you. We allow you to express your preferences, and we actually are using that in our business strategy. By the way, why do people do that stuff? This whole Web 2.0 things about people participating, why do they do this? And I think people want to spread their memes, and people want to spread their genes. So if you think about it, this old approach about, you know, why do people do things? Why do guys like to have many girls? Why do girls like to have few guys? All about the probability of having your DNA in the gene pool of the next generation. So the gene pool of the next generation now also has a meme pool for the next generation. And in some way, the web allows you to reach immortality. Also the other elements, belonging, that, you know, there you find a friend and you find similarities and so on and so forth. But all these things ultimately are driven by self-interests. So let's not fool ourselves about community stuff. Not happening. It should be self-interest. For instance, file-sharing sites. Why do people share their files on file-sharing sites? Because that way they get access to other people's files. Not for any other reason. Okay. So that's a quick story about Web 1.0, Web 2.0, and a little bit about Web 3.0 later. Now, to the second point I want to make, which is the consumer data revolution. Ultimately, that's a revolution about how people think about the data they produce. And we can talk about three different ways how people produce data. The first one is people producing implicit data about themselves. Sometimes we call it that the companies are sniffing the digital exhaust behind the person, trying to get those traces. You know, gee, where did he click? What might he have wanted? It's not easy, I can tell you that. Data mining in the 90s was, given a set of data, what insights can you get? Luckily, many companies have realized that a much easier question is, given a certain problem, what data can you get? So rather than doing that digital exhaust thing, let's just formulate the right problems and then empower people on a platform to help us out, to correct our data, to give us data. And those data they give us come in two flavors. It can be data about themselves, explicit contributions that I say who I am, what I want, what I don't want, etc. And it can be even more powerful, data about relationships between me and other people. So when I came into Singapore a couple of days ago with my passport, I think no problem. If any of you guys would have had my passport, you would have got in just as well as me. You know, probably for most Singaporeans, we all look alike. On the other hand, if some of you stole my password on Facebook, within a minute, my friends would be saying, hey, what's your problem, Andreas? Why are you talking so funny? So the relationships we have to people are much more powerful in defining us than everything we can say about ourselves. They're much more stable. They're much more robust. So the consumer data revolution is shifting expectations. Shifting expectations, how people think about the data, about themselves, and how their attitude is towards the relationships of the data they give to companies. Economics of data is actually the right approach to think about this. So what is it about? It is a shift in expectations, and people now, in exchange to giving data or to correcting data, in exchange to revealing something or helping a company, they want to have essentially better lives. That could be simpler lives, it could be discovering stuff, it could also be financial things, getting an upgrade in a hotel room, things like that. But they want to get clear value. Otherwise, it's not happening anymore. And that's very, very different from getting those boring surveys where they ask you, you know, what is your average household income, or where they even ask you about your gender. Why do they want to know my gender? So people want to see a clear value for themselves, and if possible, within 30 seconds. So now I'm giving you a couple of examples of these data people explicitly contribute. So here's a pyramid. At the bottom of the pyramid, we have clicks. Now, clicks actually don't have all that much information. Clicks have information basically only whether you click on it or not. But you don't know what comes behind the click. So we distinguish when we do data mining between long clicks, when you spend a couple of minutes carefully reading what you got to, and short clicks, where after 2 seconds you're back to Google. Short clicks are negative. People, yes, they clicked on it, but they actually didn't like what they saw there. And that's why you should, when you build a machine learning model, negatively count that click. Then we have search. Search is very powerful because it reveals intentions. I could look for a foot massage in Chinatown tonight. And that way, if somebody actually offers foot massage, any volunteers here, then, you know, hey, you know that I'm interested in that. I am revealing my intention. Now, intentions are revealed in many ways. For instance, there are some really cool so-called widgets out in Facebook. One of them is called places I want to go to. So if you're in the travel business, as we have Vigajo here, if you know that I want to go to Bangkok, because I explicitly click on the map that I want to go to Bangkok, and maybe some of my friends also want to go with me to Bangkok, and then you can say, hey, we have this new cool hotel, which also is really good in the social media, called Purman, and you can actually reach out to me, because I'm showing you my intention. On top of the pyramid is attention. Attention means, for instance, to put a tag somewhere. Attention means to label something. Why? Primarily, first of all, self-interest. I want to remember it. But then also, I'm happy to share, and then that allows me, because others share as well, to discover things I wouldn't know how to search for. Here's an example. A friend of mine, Esther Dyson, who used to run ICANN, she took this picture and she calls me here a secret weapon of many companies. And then my friend Ming Yao, who probably half of you know, says immediately, ha, that's certainly the best way to describe Andreas. So now suddenly, by having comments and having tags, the dialogue starts and things get created, a web get created on top of the traditional World Wide Web, which is meant to be created by the people who actually look at the content, by the consumers. But the consumers become producers for the navigation, in this case on Flickr, which is Yahoo's four-shared site. Okay. Now, let's take it a little bit more slowly and think, what's this got to do with business, you know? So let's think about, you know, the days and age when most of us weren't around, the 70s. I hear there were computers in the 70s. Didn't have one, but so I hear. And what happened in business? Business primarily digitized the back office. They had big machines, apparently, and tape or something like this. And there were people in the back office who did accounting and stuff like that. You probably know two quotes on this line. One is that the guy who, T.J. Watson, who ran, you know, IBM Research, said, the most we need are three computers. That's all the world needs in the 50s. What do you think about that? Actually, he got two too many. We actually only need one computer called the World Wide Web. But besides the point, in those days, it was experts, maybe 10 million people. Then the 80s, there came this new notion that the computers were connected and the front office, actually with some terminal, could talk to the back office. And if you go to the SQ counter, that's still what they have. They remember complicated T-code sequences to assign a seat to me. 90s, things became interesting. Because now it wasn't only that the front office expert could talk to the back office computer, but now actually people like us, could talk to the computer. So suddenly you had a billion people poking at stuff. That was interesting because these billion people leaked traces. Number one was the digital exhaust. That's when the day of the digital exhaust started. Now what's happening in this decade is not only that there's many people poking at stuff, but it's 100 million people producing stuff in addition to that. So that means we have peer production, most importantly, we have collaboration. Not just people dropping their stuff, but people actually reading, commenting, interacting with others. Four consequences of this. One, discovery has become a possibility in addition to search. Discovery is primarily social discovery, that I find out what my friend thinks is cool and that I try it out as well. Second, it really is a focus on people, not anymore on pages. Facebook people don't talk about their pages. They talk about their friends. Three, and this is particularly the case in Asia, we'll talk about this later, the mobile, I think, has played an enormously central role. China, as you know, has 4 times as many mobiles as PCs, 600 something million. Every day, 1 million new mobile phones get sold in China. So mobiles are really, really smart. They know so much about me. They measure the current situation. They know that I'm talking, that I'm slowly moving here. They know when I'm late for an appointment because they know where I am and where I ought to be. Give them my calendars on it. They know who my friends are. Whose emails do I answer? Whose email do I sort of delete right away before reading them? Who short message, and so on and so forth. Mobiles help us measure situation. And even in the PC world, there are ways of measuring current situation, and I want to give you a couple of examples on that, which is sensing. Number one, Company California, IMMI, Integrated Media Measurement Incorporated. Well, all you get from them is a lousy mobile phone. And actually, you can't even talk on that mobile phone. It's free, but can't do much with it. Can you know, put in your pocket, for instance, and you can't even really turn it off, like North Korea, sort of the radio. And what it does is every half minute, it records 10 seconds of the sound. It figures out what's happening, and then it reports back to headquarters and said, guess what's happening? Andreas is in the shower, 10:23 a.m. 10:23 and 30 minutes, seconds, Andreas still in the shower. 10:34, 10:35, 10:53, Andreas in the shower. Clearly, ladies and gentlemen, candidate for separate shampoo and conditioner. On the other hand, Andrew, busy guy, 6:13, Andrew in the shower, 6:14, Andrew out of the shower. Hey, dude, the one thing which from toe to hair does all the job, that's the right thing for him. Think about how good this helps us finding products. Isn't that great? What do you think about it? It really measures the situation. It knows our history. Here's another example. My camera, my microphone on my laptop, here, it asks me, allow S3 Amazon AWS.com to access your camera microphone. Of course, because that way it can actually give me better ads. It knows whether I'm here by myself, maybe with somebody, maybe when I'm in the kitchen, in the bathroom, in the shower, as discussed previously. So that's actually great. Now actually it figures out what's happening in front of the computer. It's just like a good shop assistant who actually knows what's happening and knows how to talk to you, given the situation you're in. Well, let's talk about other stuff, like my information. As you know, Viking.com, I put my mobile numbers up there and so on, but I'm not the typical guy. So let's say you want to call Stephen Miller on his mobile, because you want to complain about that grade, and you know that if you get him on his mobile, you have a better chance, maybe. So how do you find his number? Luckily, help is not far. There's a website called Jigsaw. And Jigsaw has hundreds of thousands of people who upload contact information about their friends and maybe not so friends. For a few points they can get in order to access other people. And the community corrects it. There are millions and millions of mobile numbers and other contact information. So if you want to get to the CEO of any company here, go to Jigsaw, send him that letter. There's a conversation we had. How do companies react to that? Jeff Bezos used to really very carefully shield himself from people to call him on his mobile phone. Well, there's his mobile number. I didn't put it up, by the way, just to be clear. Very good relationship with him. But hey, what do you do with this? Those things ask for new technologies, maybe one-time phone numbers. Maybe I give Ying Han a different number from a give Sean. So if Ying Han stops bothering me, then I just kill that number, but Sean can still get to me. So you see what I mean? These are all problems where the community creates data, and we have to come up with technological solutions. The question which we discussed in the panel, the question about identity, will be one of the questions which follows from this. So now let's talk about my hard drive. Who of you is totally comfortable if having his hard drive or her hard drive fully searched? What, no hands? I was just going to get somebody's computer here and look at the hard drive. Promise you don't do anything. So a hard drive is kind of private, right? But on the other hand, it has very valuable information about us. All these things which we find worth saving, all these pictures we find worth saving, good image recognition these days. So there is this company called Illumio, which says, let's look at your hard drive. And what we promise you in exchange to you allowing us access to your data is we allow you to get questions which query your expertise, and we don't bother you with irrelevant stuff. Okay, me, of course, always happy to sign up. I said, please be my guest. The first question I get is here from another student at Stanford from the GSB who asked him about SIPs, so-called statistically improbable phrases, which is something, you know, I do know about from my Amazon days. So isn't that amazing? By sharing my information, now, of course, my time doesn't get wasted anymore by some lame questions I have nothing to say about, but it's really target. I get those questions I can actually comfortably speak to. By the way, don't worry about it. It's not that my hard drive goes to that company, but it's locally indexed using Microsoft Indexer, and then actually they just compare the queries locally with what I have in my hard drive, and then if something really has a high score, it shows up on top. Let's talk about other personal stuff for Americans. Americans have very personal relationship to their cars. And here is an example of pay as you drive insurance, where you have a little GPS device in your car, and you cannot drive if that device is not on. And when the device is on, you tell it, where do you want to go? So here you are in the bar area, whatever, St. James Power Station or something like this, on a Saturday night, Sunday night, and you want to drive home. It says, 5 o'clock at night? Those tend to be lots of accidents there, for whatever reason. And that would be $50 for you to drive home. Otherwise, if you don't pay $50, the car doesn't start. And they might say, in that case, maybe I take a taxi. Changes behavior. Here's another one, even more scary, my DNA. So for $400, you can have your entire DNA. That's about as much data as you can imagine about yourself analyzed. And now this is truly my DNA here. It tells you all these things. For instance, how likely am I to be an alcoholic? Not to worry, not a problem. But all these things here are data about me. Very interesting problems. Would I put those up on the web? Who of you would put your DNA analysis up on the web? Nobody? Why not? Because none of us really trusts at least the United States government. So I don't know what would happen. Another couple of examples. Here's my friend Go Kasai. He puts up his stuff, interesting enough, they show us beautiful women over 30, I don't know why, and invites us to interact. Write something. He's had his birthday, write something. Then here you can do thumbs down on the ad, because, you know, maybe it's not the right ad. And 0.1% of all people who show these ads actually click on thumbs down and then give a reason, for instance, too pornographic or not pornographic enough or whatever the reasons are. And then down here, you have a regular ad. You can purchase a book like Join the Conversation, a book about conversation marketing, again, about 0.1% click-through rate. Facebook is not for selling stuff. You know, I did a number of focus groups at Stanford, and it's very clear. Forget about trying to sell stuff there. It's about communication, about interacting between people. Another sort of interaction is a company called Skydeck, which actually is very, very interesting. I just give them my username or my mobile phone number and the password on my T-Mobile, is my carrier in the United States, for the website of T-Mobile. And then they go every day, screen scrape, or maybe have an API, and then report back to me, hey, what were your COP conversations last week? So they give me self-metrics. So one important drive is people like to learn about themselves. That's why all these books and these quizzes and questions in magazines, people like to learn about themselves. And so they tell me that Go is actually one of my COP conversations. Then there are winners and losers in my address book, and we find that, for instance, poor Ming Yao fell in the numbers here. And then it also does viral marketing, of course, and says, hey, Tom Gieselman, who is a VC I work with, I should invite him to Skydeck. Probably they need money at Skydeck. They need another round of VC funding. I think, yeah, even my Tom might be a good start. So all of these things analyze my data. So we talked this morning about a number of things. We talked about marketing in this workshop we had, and we said the number of P's. And if you think about it, how these traditional P's of marketing, product, pricing, promotion, placement are affected. Product, you have instrumented the world. You get feedback. In me business and we business, in this consumer data revolution, you get so much information. Between the workshop in the morning and the afternoon here, I spend an hour and 50 minutes at Singapore Airlines at the airport and talk to the couple of EVPs there, including the marketing head, what that means to them. That people are talking about SQ and a number of written boards. flatseats.com, and so on and so forth. And what choice does SQ have? They can, of course, close their eyes and say, well, you know, we have the most beautiful posters of Shoutiers bending over, helping the customers, and we don't need to know about any seats being broken. Or they can say, gee, you know, these are real, genuine people giving us feedback. So maybe we should listen to them.
Yeah.
Pricing, you can do experiments, same thing, promotions, recommendations, placement, all that. There are actually two more P's. One of them we tend not to talk about in Singapore. And the other one is, of course, a platform. And Facebook was the example for the platform. So platforms means that things are happening, and I want to give you one example here, what's called conversational marketing. Typically, there are conversations companies have. For instance, my fund manager at Fidelity Investments sends me every week a newsletter, a conversation with your fund manager. The only thing is, I've never talked to him. And I actually never had a real conversation with him. But he calls it a conversation. Well, he can call it whatever he wants to call it. But normal people wouldn't call that a conversation if you just send out a letter to people. So that's still a somewhat personal example. Much more serious is, of course, sort of talking about conversations when you just send out the same flyer to millions of people. That's the traditional marketing. Many PR releases, including us sending you about the Shaw Lecture here, this flyer, are traditional downcasting. But that's not where the conversations are happening. The conversations are happening down here between individuals. People talking about laptops, about mobile phones, about mobile phone service, about the cockroaches in the hotels, whatever the topics are. That's where the conversations are. So how should companies react? Companies should react to this consumer data revolution by listening in, by spending a couple of days of looking at the top blogs, of trying to understand whether the sentiment tends to be positive or the sentiment tends to be negative. And then, in a very authentic way, they can enter those conversations. Why would they enter those conversations? Ultimately, most companies are in the business of selling stuff. So let's talk for a moment how recommendations have changed. You probably all know the Amazon feature, people who bought X also bought Y. And what it does is item-by-item filtering, and we came up with that in order to actually not have to go via product data, because that's just very expensive. If you have 50 million items, if you only pay a dollar for getting each product, it's $50 million out of the window just to get your product description. And they change all the time, too expensive. So you need to find some way how you leverage the community, WeBusiness in the early days, to actually help you make suggestions. So the most traditional one is here, that the purchases people bought X also bought Y. More interesting, I thought, was a feature which took 10 years for us to have the idea, which is quite strange, to say, well, people looked at this, eventually bought that. Much more powerful. Because in this process of decision-making, you actually get people upstream and then push them downstream to where most people go. Amazon is super honest in the sense that none of these numbers are ever false. So people always ask me, but don't you push the numbers up of those items with a higher profit margin? No. Why would we? Because Amazon sees itself as supporting the decision-making process. That's just one tiny bit of data up there. Let's talk about other data sources. Forward, tell a friend, hey, that pushes towards Web 3.0. So if I find something cool and I forward go about that, then you know he knows and Amazon knows that we are friends and that I think he's interested in something. So Amazon recovers the underlying, make explicit the underlying implicit social structure. Annotate. Friday.com has a very nice feature which allows you to annotate people in the dating site. So that means that now I show my attention by privately, just for myself, saying things about the person. Search. Search reveals intention. Location. Location reveals situation. So those are data sources which typically most companies, including you know many banks, don't really know how to use yet. But they're very, very powerful data sources. It actually doesn't cost all that much because technology is cheap. In many cases, actually, it really is just more a thinking thing. But of course, they don't have fault tolerance. You can't trust those. So my bank, you know, I would not be happy if said, those $100,000 you gave us, sorry, we can't find it. Like I said, that email you sent, sorry, I can't find it. So a very different level of service level agreements there. That's on the data side. On the people side, you know, I'm a people person, things are much more interesting even. There are friends meaning specific people you know. And viral marketing is certainly one feature there, how we can exploit those bridges people have. And their peers. Peers are different from fans. So let's say a peer, if you have 7 children, then you need a certain car, and you look for other peers who also have 7 children, also need to buy cars. Peers are very important in China. So taking cars in China, where do Chinese people, mainland Chinese people, go when they need information about a car? Their dad, no car. Their uncle, no car. Their brother, no car. So of course, they go to the web. And if you look actually what the car business in China, it's very interesting that almost all of that, almost all the decision-making doesn't come from BMW telling people stuff, Fahrvergnügen, but it's people talking about it. Even people producing products, peer-produced, on the web. Like Toyota Camry had a keychain, which was apparently no good. So people talked about it on the bulletin board, and then a few days later, somebody spoke up in Guangdong province and said, hey, I can produce a thing which actually solves that problem. And here, for a few RMB, you can buy it. Toyota didn't even know about it. Very interesting. And finally, of course, more traditionally, we have experts, we have journalists, we have, in the fashion case, fashion bloggers who often make the fashion because often people don't know what they actually want. So, 3 or 4 slides for summary. First of all, what we have is a data revolution, not a software revolution. So the term IT has changed over the years. You remember the slide, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s. Now we are squarely in a data revolution. And that means that the economics of data is actually what we should pay attention to. Example, a company called Navtec was acquired a year ago by Nokia for $8 billion. Navtec spent $300 million just to break even before they could sell their maps or could make more than they paid, because they had 1,000 people driving through the world and figuring out, you know, where the streets are. 1,000 people. Nokia this year is selling 100,000 mobile phones with GPS devices, 10 to 5 times more. So think about the quality of data Nokia can produce after having bought sort of the base thing, compared to what Navtec would have to pay to have 100,000 people driving through the world. Amazon certainly is a wonderful example of a company which recognized early on that users can add value. A very interesting story about Google and Google Maps. When at some stage, maybe 4 years ago by now, Google realized that some guy had hacked into the system and sort of stole Google Maps and repurposed it on his page. There was an interesting discussion at the company. No problem to fill that hole. That is easy done. And then somebody said, why would we want to do that? Why not actually open it up and let other people work for us? Let other people annotate our pages. Let other people create value for us on our terms. If they want to do it, great. Very interesting how this happened. My question is, of course, when will airlines follow? When will banks follow? What truly are the things that are holding them back? So this traditional data business that people specialize in creating data, get paid for it, really is turning upside down. Let's talk back here about the Navtec Nokia example. Right now, I'm paying $10 a month for my subscription, which tells me how the traffic is, so if I when I have to leave at home in order to get to school. But if I'm opening up my GPS data, shouldn't Nokia be paying me? Because they couldn't come up with the information product without having access to my data. It's one of those things where it's unclear which way the needle goes. Axiom Corporation helps people make the decisions, who should I send my ads to? Powering 24 out of 25 financial institutions in the United States. Is interesting because the economics of communication has changed. It used to be that the main cost was on the side of the sender, $1 to send a letter. So the sender had to use intelligence to figure out who should I send my brochure to. OCBC, beautiful brochure. Well, it's $1 each, so better not be too generous. Better use some machine learning to figure out based on demographics, psychographics, and so on, who to send it to. That cost of reaching a potential customer has dropped from $1 to less than a cent if you're doing the web. The cost that has not changed is the cost of the recipient, namely the cost of my attention. So just as before, I need to parse this. I get an interrupt. Interrupts are more costly than people think. And suddenly what used to be the negligible term, namely, hey, they pay a dollar, I pay little, becomes, because this has dropped by 2 orders of magnitude, becomes the main term. So now I need something which negotiates my attention. And I'm willing to pay for that. For instance, that mobile phone, where I can push after the phone number another digit which tells you how important I think that phone call is for the recipient, not for me as a sender, but for the receiver. And then if the receiver agrees with that, then, hey, I get through to Yao much more easily. If I think, Yao, you really should know about the call, but Yao says, no, I don't want to hear from Andreas, then, you know, next time I don't even get this phone to ring anymore. Lots of other examples. One of them, I hear that Singaporeans are interested in real estate. So user-generated data, yes, there was something called multiple listings for many years already in the United States, but it was a big information asymmetry that you as an end user didn't have access to it. You go to somebody who says, oh, yes, young man, I know what you need, and let's go on a trip. And for that, you pay them 3% and 3% for the seller's agent. 6% of $1,060,000 for somebody taking you on a trip. Pretty ridiculous. So companies came along, Zillow, Redfin, Trulio being examples, and said, we can aggregate this information. And now we have rich databases about the value of houses on the web, and people can actually disintermediate those agents and just save 6% of the transaction. I sold my house in Seattle, for instance, without going through the agent. So last point is what I call rebusiness customer service. Customer service is actually new marketing because people come to you already. It's not that you spent that dollar and if you have a response rate of whatever, 2%, actually $50 to acquire a new customer, but here's the customer who is already coming to you. So Get Satisfaction is a platform where 6,000-7,000 companies are already present. And what it allows you to do is primarily if customers help other customers. So if I have a problem with my mobile phone, which is a T-Mobile phone, but I'm here on Singtel, or maybe M1, maybe on StarHub, and it's a BlackBerry, I don't know why it's not working. So it's hard for me. I call one of them, they say, oh, it's always the other. That's how it works, at least in America. And what they do is they say, well, pose a question. Let's see who can help you. Companies help, individuals help, add to the knowledge pool here. And then you have a way of, if you're an employee of the company, to actually say, hey, I actually know how it really is, and they verify your email address and say, yes, this guy indeed has an email address at tmobile.com, and this means you're an employee. I don't have internet access here, unfortunately, otherwise I would show you some in real time. So the trends are that the attitude of consumers to the data they produce has shifted dramatically. For companies, the question has changed from, given a set of data, what insights can we get, to given a certain problem, what data can we get? And people only give them data if they see the value, and that on a relatively fast time scale. Marketing, we have moved from traditional market research to now actually each individual with all their actions helping us and helping themselves with their actions. Production, we move from a controlled production where every minute, every second of the PR piece was choreographed to, well, an uncontrolled production by the masses. Most of it, probably not relevant, some of it very relevant. So the problem becomes to find a relevance function. And the main use of all this data is to help people find that stuff which is of relevance to them. And finally, for consumption has moved very much towards the edge of the distribution, towards the long tail, where people serendipitously discover things they wouldn't even have known to look for. Specifically here in the me business, we business world, some of the questions have very different answers now from what they used to have. Who talks to whom? It's consumers to consumers. Who trusts whom? It's again the shift from institution to individuals. Who is in control? Well, it's no longer the company. It's in me business, the individuals are in control. The balance of power has shifted. Who manages whom? It's not the company targeting, it's the individual saying, hey, make me an offer. What are the new metrics? No longer eyeballs, but metrics of engagement. And who pays whom? Not clear. Not clear what the metrics are of paying people. Because If you design incentives for people, not everybody is just interested in saving the last cent. Amazon found out by showing people where else they can buy the same book, possibly cheaper. People still didn't go to the other place, but stayed at Amazon. They're happy to pay maybe 10% premium because they know if something goes wrong, then they can send it back. And they know that if they order the book in the next 7 hours and 24 minutes, then it will still arrive tomorrow. That's a position people are more than happy to pay for. In short, the last graph here, this pyramid has changed. That here was the pyramid of e-business, of the company on top deciding of what's happening, or in France, the Académie Française deciding on how to say something, or Germany to do the redaction, whatever it is. And that pyramid has changed upside down of basically, as Clay Shirky has in his new book, here comes everybody. I had my 45 minutes. I would like to now open up here for discussion. The slides, as well as the slides of this morning's masterclass, the Consumer Data Revolution, Realize the Truth of Your Customers and Data Create, will be on the web on viking.com, and I invite you to look them up. I'll also put the MP3 of my talk on that. Thank you very much for your attention.